compensate for being in that time on Air Force One. And that's such a powerful thing that people don't really, you know, they don't really.
Get around the radio, kids. It's time for Strictly Confidential. It's the homosexual agenda on steroids, putting the dominionists and the loyal Bushies and the rest of America's underbelly on notice that the GLBT community is simply not going to take it anymore. So, just like gay kryptonite, here's Peter Godbold.
Good evening, America, and good morning, world. Welcome to Book, Chapter, and Verse 108 of Strictly Confidential. I am Peter Godbold, and welcome to the LGBT version of Conversation Radio, exclusively on the listener-supported Head On Radio Network. Thank you for making Strictly Confidential a part of your day. Today is, in fact, Thursday, January the 24th, 2008. So if you're listening shortly after 9 p.m. on Thursday, January the 24th, 2008, you are indeed listening to a live show, and you're welcome to participate. I'll be giving out the toll-free numbers and the toll numbers shortly. If you're not listening shortly after 9 p.m., you're listening to one of the archive streams, and we appreciate your listening in any way. We are glad to have you participate in the show and email us later or email us during the show or call in any way you'd like to participate. This is Conversation Radio. Bob is completely correct that many people do listen to these shows as a podcast or a stream. In fact, probably the majority of the listeners to this network do listen at their own schedule at some point other than the time that it is actually airing. Of course, being listed over at White Rose Society is a huge advantage. White Rose Society, of course, carries our streams and is known to be the holy grail aggressive talk radio on the Internet. You can find millions of hours there. Maybe you might like to drop White Rose a email to webmaster@whiterosesociety.org, and we can get Strictly Confidential there, too. You will find the name there, but actually there are no working links all the way back to August, July, something like that. But anyway, it would be great to have this show available as an archive there, too. That's a wonderful advantage to be included amongst the wonderful progressive programming over at White Rose Society. The show site is strictlyconfidentialradio.com, and there you're going to find links to all of the guests as well as to the audio archives from past shows. You'll find links to our chat room, which is active as we speak. You'll find links to the main Head On Radio Network site, where you can find out about all the other progressive programming on the Head On Radio Network. There are links there for Strictly Confidential's MySpace page, and links to help you locate the music that you hear on the show. As I said, the toll-free line is 877, the number 4, Head On. That translates into 877-443-2366. That's 877-443-2366. If you have unlimited long distance, please use that. You'll save listener-supported radio a nickel or a buck. That's area code 304-658-3333. That's 304-658-3333, and that rings in West Virginia. Email arrives to Peter at headonradionetwork.com, and I do try to check the mail during the breaks. We do have a guest this evening. The guest will be joining us at 9:30, and I'm thrilled to have this man with us this evening. It is Alexander Robinson, and he is the executive director of the National Black Justice Coalition. They can be found at nbjc.org. They also have a MySpace page, which I'll give you later. These people are incredibly involved in the rights of black LGBT citizens and their families. They're involved in the Don't Ask, Don't Tell policies. They're involved with Soul Force regarding a dialogue with churches regarding what's going on with the are being called the snakes in the Garden of Eden, which we talked about a little bit last night. I'm looking to this is a very dynamic man, and I'm very much looking to talking with him this evening. And and love for you to participate in that. His name again is Alexander Robinson, and he is with the National Black Justice Coalition. In fact, the National Black Justice Coalition came up during the interview with Soul Force. Soul Force has been on a couple of times. They came up when talking to Service Members Legal Defense Network. And in fact, I believe there is a third interview that we've done on this network that has, and National Black Justice Coalition has come up many times. So this is one of the organizations we definitely want to talk to, and we'll probably want to talk to again in the near future. So that's the scoop. Oh, yeah, I want to tell you this evening that the Gay Bar Across the Street segment, we're going to be running probably about 10:25 this evening, and I'm thrilled to tell you it is DJ Jerry Bonham, and Jerry is going to be bringing us mixes from the Trocadero. These were done in 2007, back in, I think it was October of 2007, in San Francisco, and they are indeed wonderful. The music is wonderful. Looking forward to that. He is actually in Spain, I believe, right now. He's traveling. But we do have his music. I heard from him via email today, and he's glad to participate in the show. And a wonderful kid, probably closer to my age, but oh, hell, we're all kids around here. Where do we begin? Where do we begin on a Thursday evening in the land of the free? Oh, yes, I don't mean to laugh at your fathers and your brothers and your mothers and your sisters who have died defending this country. In fact, I lift them up. What I do laugh at is the sham that it has become under the Bush administration. A little note, I wasn't going to start with this story, but this was sent late. Our friend Gene sent this it was just before the show started. I'm sure I have it here somewhere. It may help to explain George Bush. Let's see. I know I have it stashed. Here we go. You know, our friend Gene, who's one of our news ninjas, constantly keeps us updated with the most fascinating scientific sites regarding anything from physics to astronomy to German scientists, as we're going to tell in this short paragraph. But it may help to explain the phenomenon that we have come to know as George W. Bush. The German scientists recently showed what many of us suspected but could not prove. Some people just don't learn. The German researchers have found a genetic factor that affects our ability to learn from our errors. Interesting. The scientists have demonstrated that men carrying the A1 mutation are less successful at learning and avoiding mistakes and avoiding repeating mistakes than men who do not carry this A1 genetic mutation. And this finding has the potential to improve our understanding of what causes addictive and compulsive behaviors, especially related to, shall we say, a lifetime of screw-ups and bailouts. And that's really all there is to it. It's just a short paragraph, but that needed to be said. It's the A1, President. Yes, we have the A1 mutation walking around in the halls of the White House right now with skid marks in his underwear and blood on his hands. I guarantee you. I guarantee you. Oh, my. No, I won't go there. Okay. This is a great story. In fact, I'm going to do this story, but I really love to have these kids on the show. Remember, we had the couple that had been together for 62 years on the show a while back, a gay couple. That was a great interview. These guys have not been together for 62 years. In fact, they were just recently married, and they present a wonderful story. This is a story from Iowa, as a matter of fact, from the Iowa Register, the staff there, and the staff writer. Yes, from Des Moines. Lord have mercy. It starts as a sort of an image, a story. A crowd of well, it was mostly reporters or photographers. They circle these two young men under a maple tree in Iowa. And Sean Fritz, who has a beard and was dripping with sweat, threw his arms around the tall, red-headed Tim McQuillan. And with a kiss, their marriage is sealed. And so they have become the poster children of gay marriage in Iowa. In fact, they are the only couple married in the state of Iowa that is, in fact, a same-sex couple. Now, move on to another image that occurs 138 days later. Hundreds have marched from the Iowa State House to the Iowa Supreme Court, and they are chanting, "One man, one woman, one man, one woman," repeatedly, over and over again, like some sort of automaton under the spell of the fundamentalists. We've had that audio on the show several weeks ago, no point running again. That's really the only thing there is to it, just a crowd of imbeciles screaming, "One man, one woman, one man, one woman." And they are marching from the State House to the Iowa Supreme Court. It was a January, and they prayed as the snow fell. They prayed that the legislators put a ban on gay marriage in the Constitution, because Sean and Tim epitomize the fear, the worst fear these marchers have, these two men. After many months of a quiet married life, in Ames, Iowa, by the way, Sean is 24, and Tim, his married partner, he's 21. They've now returned to the media storm as Iowa's most visible symbol of gay marriage. And again, I point out, the only symbol of Iowa's gay marriage. Sean says it's awkward to see people pretending that we're not people at all, that we're just a demographic, that we are here to vilify people, that we are here to destroy other families. Sean says, "I mean, I'm not a demographic. It's me. It's my marriage. It's my partner, Tim. It's us. We are human beings. And this stuff hurts. And it's so much more than one marriage between two people." There's a story here that the two are self-proclaimed computer nerds. You gotta love them just for that alone. One is a computer scientist looking for work, and the other is a linguistics major at Iowa State University. And they are going to continue to be the poster children in Iowa until the Iowa Supreme Court rules on the gay marriage case later this year, or in 2009 perhaps. Their marriage and all it represents will continue to be vilified and defecated on by people that we call values voters, which is slang for "God hates everybody I hate." You know, these people so quickly say God is on our side. Oh, they never ask themselves if they're on God's side. No, it's God's on our side. Therefore, our petty prejudices and what we think is what God thinks, or he wouldn't be on our side. And I know he's on our side. I could feel it in my heart. Well, maybe you do, sir, but that does not change the fact that you are a bigot. Now, Sean and Tim, the controversy and the symbolism that surrounds their marriage is actually the small part. What they never thought they would have to go through is the attention that they're getting. And, in fact, if I'm able to contact them on the show, it'll even be more attention. But hell, they're 24 and 21. They could handle it a lot better than I could handle it. I'm actually very proud of you guys. The attention that, they married just because they wanted to show their commitment to each other, not to become the poster children. They are fine with it, though. They are reconciling themselves to becoming the spokespeople for the cause of gay marriage in the state of Iowa. And they're okay with the photographs from their wedding being featured in the New York Times and fielding calls from national television shows and even some internet radio shows over the next few days. Love to have these guys. But the complicated part takes place when the two step out of the spotlight and return to their regular married life, and they find out, as so many couples do, that there's a hell of a lot more to marriage than they had ever expected. Tim says, it's difficult, it's difficult, it's difficult. It's a hard concept to get in your head at first. He said, it's much more monumental than we give it credit for. It's very hard to describe in words. Tim says, I hadn't expected anything like this would ever happen to me. I hadn't considered it and didn't even have time to think about it. And then this happens, and it's like worlds colliding. The whole universe blows up, and it is so opposite of everything I grew up with and everything I have learned about and know about. It is so opposite of everything that I have built my life up to. Let's talk about some of their personal memories. Sean Fritz. Now, when he was 12 years old, he was hyperactive and headstrong. He lived with his pharmacist mother. He had a stay-at-home father, too, and a younger brother. They are a Catholic household, and Sean was an altar boy. One day in school, Sean realized he had been checking out a boy. And Sean asked himself, am I gay? And the answer that came back was, well, yes. So he doesn't tell anyone. 2 years later, though, Sean is in the ninth grade, which is high school, the very first grade of high school. And a classmate writes homo, H-O-M-O. I guess he couldn't spell the whole word. Homo on Sean's backpack. And his mother immediately takes Sean to buy a new backpack. So they're driving home from the store, and his mother asks, almost offhand, doing the mother very casual sort of thing, are you gay? And Sean just sort of sits there and kind of chills and just ignores the question, but mommy was not going to let this drop. And again, she asked me the question. Sean said, she said, are you gay? And so I said, meaning Sean said, yeah. And then Sean's mother said, well, that's cool. Then Sean told his mother, don't tell Dad. And she says, fine, I won't. So when they got home, mother and Sean, who's in the ninth grade of high school with his new backpack, mother and Sean go into Sean's bedroom, and they sit on the bed together, and they cry. His mother is shocked, but she doesn't want her son to realize that, because he's, of course, vulnerable, and so she tells him she loves him, and in fact she does. His mother remarks, Mary, her name, at that moment he was the moment before. She said, he is my son, and no matter what difficulties I had or the challenges he has ahead, I accept him for who he is. Now, Sean, this is more about Sean. Sean gets his first boyfriend at age 16, and then Sean comes out to his father at 17, and Sean goes to Indian Hills Community College at 18, and he takes an IT job at 19. I told you they were computer geeks. And he goes to ISU, which I'm not mistaken, it's Iowa State University. I didn't bother to look it up, but I'm fairly certain that's what it is. I'm not from that neck of the woods, you understand. Everything north of Atlanta is up north. So in any case, goes to ISU at 23. And, typical kids, the relationships really never lasted longer than a month. And he says he didn't fit in with the Will and Grace version of gay culture. And neither do I might like to point out. He has a scruffy beard, loves computer programming, and doesn't dress that well. In fact, sounds like me, sans the scruffy beard. One summer day before Sean's senior year of college, another student from the college friends him, which is how it works on sites like MySpace and Facebook. Anyway, another student who apparently attended the same university friended him on Facebook, facebook.com. And, of course, friending is just you add each other so that your messages go back and forth and your postings won't happen. So in any case, after that, Sean and Tim began talking on the phone, and their conversations turned intellectual. They talked about artificial intelligence, Tim talked about his genetics class. They talked about their favorite science fiction. Is this not the love of the nerds? You gotta love these guys. And eventually, after discussing these things on the phone and over Facebook, they set up a date. Now we move to Tim's memories. Now, Tim McQuillan is 12. We'll start with Tim when he was 12 years old. It's New Year's Day in 1999. It was cold and it was gray, and Tim had just returned from Des Moines, where his dad, a bowling alley manager, lives. You know, I used to wonder why bowling was such a big deal. It seems to be a much bigger deal in the North than it is in the South. I mean, we have bowling alleys here, but oft times in movies and when people are in conversation, you'll see a bowling alley in the movie. It just seems to be more of them. I finally caught on, though. I thought about it for a while. I finally realized it's cold as hell up there, and it's snowing. You really can't do a whole lot. So finally, when I put it together with the weather, I caught on to why bowling is so much bigger up there. Not that there's anything wrong with that. I've been bowling. I'm just saying that I figured it out. I eventually figure out just about everything, but it takes many, many, many years. In any case, they had returned from Des Moines, and his father is a bowling alley manager. And when he got home, the phone rang, and he had returned to his mother's home, and it was his mother's phone that rang, and she answers, and her voice took on a serious tone, and she gathered the kids together, and she tells them that their father had just died of a heart attack. Tim says that the death of his father changed everything. He was once a hyper youngster who bounced around the house pretending he was a teenage mutant ninja turtle. All of that boisterous activity disappeared. He turned inward. He buried his nose in his old science fiction favorites written by people like Jules Verne and probably Isaac Asimov. And he falls in love with the Internet. And he has another memory of a few years later. He was friends with a girl in school. I think it was high school. It was a few years later, past 12, he's probably in high school. He was friends with a girl. And he was afraid that she was going to want a date. He was freaking out because these are things that, you know, it does occur to you if you're straight. But I'll tell you, all gay kids go through this. I mean, oh my God. I mean, I like her and I want to talk to her because she's cool. We're friends. But oh my God, what if she wants to date? What do I do now? So anyway, he was afraid she wanted to date. So instead, what he did, she became the very first person that he tells that he's gay. And she was like, really? I would have never guessed. And Tim says, as he's told people over the years, he gets that reaction every time. I would have never guessed, is what people say. And it's because he doesn't use lip balm or hairstyling products, and he doesn't dress well. And he says, I'm just not what people think about when they think about gay guys. So when Tim was 15, his family moved to California near a gay-friendly area of Palm Springs, and Tim told still hadn't told his family he was gay. But in Palm Springs, he didn't fit in with the predominantly gay culture because he didn't use hairstyling products and he didn't dress well. God, I love these guys. They're like me. They're like mini-me's. Anyway, he graduates from high school, and he goes to work with an IT job, and his sister convinces him to enroll in ISU. And then one summer day in Ames, he finds an interesting guy on Facebook, and they set up a date. So now you see where these stories merge. So it's date night. There's a jazz band. It's playing at the cafe, and Tim and Sean leave the cafe for a stroll. The evening is warm and humid, and they walk toward a park bench and circle back to a street called Welch Avenue. And suddenly, Sean grabbed Tim's hand. Well, Tim was very uncomfortable at first. He said that Sean let go. He didn't want to make me do something I didn't want to do. He let go, and then I felt stupid because there weren't that many people around. And I was thinking, you know, some of those cars might recognize me. I was completely paranoid. These are thoughts that go through LGBT's heads in public. You know, holding hands is, you don't know what you're going to get. I mean, not only might you be attacked, what do you do if somebody attacks your partner? Can you defend your partner? You have to get it. Just holding hands, you have to you have to go into nuclear mode. You have to go into armament mode because of the risks that your loved one could incur just by holding hands. He finally thought to himself, what's the use of paranoid if I really feel that I love him? And at that point, I did. And they talked about spending their lives together. They moved in together at Christmas. Tim finally tells his mother he's gay. She cries, not from the news, but she cried because he told her that he had feared telling her. So that was the thing that upset her. And so one evening in August, Sean hears that gay marriage has become legal in Polk County. And he calls Tim's mother and asks Tim's mother for permission to marry her son. Isn't that sweet? And Sean bought the 2 gold wedding bands, and he picked Tim up from work. And in the parking lot, he said, will you marry me? And he gave him a white rose. A white rose was in his hand. And the next day, before the judge in Iowa suspended, by the way, the Iowa has suspended gay marriage immediately afterwards due to pressures from the insane people who tend to get a little upset when they hear stories like this, because we are the snake in the garden, if you'll recall that from last night. So anyway, before the judge ruling is suspended, though, they became the only same-sex couple to ever get married in Iowa. And so it's nearly 5 months later, and Sean and Tim sit in a cafe and reflect on their marriage. And the months after the wedding were total chaos. There was a Labor Day honeymoon in Des Moines, hectic week of reporters and phoning and showing up the door. They had to catch up on missed schoolwork. They both fell back into smoking cigarettes because of the stress. They began reading angry comments about their marriage posted below news stories and in blogs, and then the insults being thrown at them about their relationship. They finally learned to ignore that. It wasn't until after the finals and after the holidays, when this had died down some, they were able to give up smoking again, and they've been able to reflect on this. They said now that they never realized how much they wanted marriage till after they were married. He said, I now realize how important marriage is. Sean says, I've known I was gay since I was a teenager, and gay marriage was always something that's going to happen in the future, but I couldn't get one. It wasn't on the table. It wasn't available for me. And then all of a sudden, it is on the table, and I got one. And I was like, whoa, I really wanted this the whole time. This is what I wanted. This is what I longed for. It was off the table, though. I just couldn't. I couldn't wrap my head around it, is basically what he's saying. I told myself it just wasn't feasible. So they believe, Tim and Sean believe, that the stereotypical gay culture is filled with superficial relationships, because if you look at the pop culture's gay role models, what do you get? You get Will and Grace, and Jack and Will don't have any meaningful relationships. You get Queer Eye for the Straight Guy. That focuses on fashion and wine, but has very little substance. They're wondering if this superficiality that many perceive is part of not allowing gays to marry, not a part of not having it on the table. And they wonder if that means that every gay relationship is destined to be temporary. Of course, we know this is not true after talking to our couple who've been together 62 years and other couples who we've talked to with or without their partner on the show. He goes on to say, you treat children like children. They're going to behave like children if you treat them like children. If you treat them like adults and say that you expect them to get married and to take responsibility and to, you know, form a relationship and be stable, then that's what the expectation is. That's where you go. I've never been expecting to be able to get married. It's pretty strange social conditioning to go through. And any case, there's a discussion about gay role models. They say they weren't stereotypical. They weren't artistic. They aren't bohemian. They didn't identify with Rent. And hopefully someone who reads this was in the situation I was, Tim said, and someone who isn't sure about themselves. I'm not casting myself as an ideal role model, but I think there's some good out of letting people know our story. And I certainly agree with that. And I would love to have that couple on the show. By the way, Sean is very tall, red hair, and Tim is a shorter man with the little scraggly beard. Cute couple. We are now going to welcome us to the show. And as I said earlier, I'm thrilled to have Alexander Robinson with us this evening. He's the CEO and the executive director of the National Black Justice Coalition. The site for them, by the way, is nbjc.org. There's also a MySpace page, myspace.com/nbjcdc, because they're located in Washington, D.C. The National Black Justice Coalition is a civil rights organization that's dedicated to empowering black, same-gender-loving, lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgendered people, and it works with communities and forms allies for social justice and equality to end racism and homophobia. Mr. Alexander Robinson is the executive director, as I said, of the coalition. The coalition was launched a few years back by Keith Boykin, by the way. Keith Boykin was a former Clinton staffer and has emerged as one of the nation's top African-American authors and activists. Both Robinson and Boykin had a lot to say about Louis Farrakhan's remarks about the down low, which we can talk about later. In any case, I am thrilled to have him on the show with us this evening. Alexander, welcome to Strictly Confidential.
Well, thank you. I'm happy to be here.
I'm happy to have you here. You have come up, your organization has come up so many times. I've got to tell you, you were brought up when we had the people from Soul Force on. I think both times Soul Force was on, you came up. Your organization came up when we had the Service Members Legal Defense Network on the show regarding some of the activities and things that you've done against the Don't Ask, Don't Tell situation. And there was one other guest a while back that you came up with. Darn if I can't remember who, but I am just delighted to have you here with us this evening. Alexander, tell us about the organization. We'd love to hear it.
Well, as you mentioned, we were founded back in 2004, and really out of a response to the organizing, as many of your listeners might remember, at that time, there was a lot of organizing going on in African-American churches in particular in support of the federal amendment that would have defined marriage as being only between a man and a woman. And in the mainstream media and black media, really all we heard from African-American voices were individuals who were supporting that, it constitutes one amendment. And so there were, 10 or 15 of us who stepped forward and said, we have to actually put out an alternative voice and say, not only are there those of us who believe that this amendment is wrong, but there are those of us who are same-gender-loving gay and lesbian folks and African-American and are fully supportive of us being treated equally. And so since that time, we've expanded our agenda to include lots of issues, including racial justice issues and the whole range of gay and lesbian civil rights issues, and we've been active across the country.
I noticed this thing coming up with Soul Force, that you're going to be approaching some of the, what can I call them, mega churches. Several are listed here. One of the pardon me? Go ahead, please.
No, I didn't say anything.
Oh, I'm sorry. We just had a little glitch on the line. The Internet is like that. We were connected via the Internet. You never know what you're going to hear. So in any case, you are going to be apparently working with Soul Force to visit a list of them, everybody from Saddleback Church to the Potter's House in Dallas, Texas, and a list of others. And apparently here in a recent article, Focus on the Families has a fellow there named Price, and he has sent out a warning to all of the churches telling them not to listen to Soul Force or to you as the connection. And he says that as with any temptation to disregard God's clear word on any given matter, this attempt by Soul Force and their allies is a classic example of what we see in Genesis, where the serpent tempts Eve by asking, did God really say this, that, and the other? This homophobic thing has gone back so far in the church, and it seems that the current administration and the right wing is stirring the pot so badly How do you see it regarding some of the... Well, you know, we've talked about a minister named Hutchison in California who's virulently anti-gay and going after Microsoft, and apparently the right is courting some of the black ministers of some of the larger churches to install this divide. Is that something you see?
Oh, absolutely. You know, as you say, a lot of the source of homophobia, anti-gay sentiment, comes out of what we believe is a misinterpretation of Scripture to say that homosexuality, being same-gender loving, is sinful and immoral. And that's an issue that clearly was a divisive one within the African-American communities. And there have been those who have exploited it for their own political purposes. And that's, I believe, what we're seeing, certainly what we saw in 2004, 2005, in the last election cycle. And I believe that they continue to do that. We're working with Cellforce because since the beginning of the organization, we were very clear that if we were ever going to turn the community around on these issues, that we had to confront religious bigotry head on. And quite frankly, that's what, you know, how we see this issue. Now, it's one of the few places that we're still allowed to use Scripture and religion to excuse bigotry. Of course, Scripture was used to justify slavery, used to justify the subjugation of women. We've kind of gotten past that even if that's your religious belief, we now, in, you know, secular civil society, we don't accept that as a way that it's appropriate to act. But when it comes to issues around gay and lesbian folks, we even see sometimes our allies, people who are otherwise our friends, saying, well, you know, that's what they believe the Bible says, so we have to respect that. And while certainly people are free to believe what they want, when they bring it into the public square, we have to call it out for what it is.
That is not always the easiest thing to do. I respect you for doing that. How is it with the black pastors and the clergy, the African American clergy? Do you have a lot of allies in that community, or do you see mostly hostility? See, we just don't know here. We want to know these things so badly.
Well, we're building our network of allies. You know, I would say that we have the closet, the unwillingness to be open and honest, does not only afflict individuals who are themselves gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgender, same-gender loving people. It also affects our family, our friends, and particularly those within many religious traditions who support us. They support us as friends. They support us in the workplace. They're with us, but as soon as they get to church, as soon as they get within, you know, the sanctuary, then their willingness to stand up against the pastor and their willingness to speak out and speak what they know to be the truth becomes weakened. And so part of our role has been to encourage them, to expose them to those congregations and churches that are open and affirming, so that they will then have the courage of their own convictions to speak up and be more openly supportive.
You know, it is a mind-numbing thing do you find the same pattern in the black congregations that we see in the larger white congregations where most of the people never really read the Bible for themselves? They just take it as the pastor's word, as this is what it means. My impression of the black community has always been that it's more introspective and contemplative regarding Scripture than, you know, a lot of the white people are. What are your thoughts about that? Am I totally off base here?
Well, I think that you do have a lot of Bible reading, and you do have a lot of quoting of Scripture. and in some cases, so-called study of Scripture. But I think that often what's lacking is context, clear exegesis, as some would explain, really taking the text as it's written, understanding that it's been translated many times, understanding the circumstances under which it was written, and then having some interpretation, some understanding of what it means. You know, those who would take Scripture, you know, fundamentally and say that, you know, these exact words that we're reading here now, you know, have a meaning, and that's the meaning we should prescribe to them. Anyone who's ever read a piece of literature that's been translated or tried to have a conversation with someone who spoke a foreign language will understand that you have to have a lot of knowledge about the context of what people are saying. Phrases are different. And so I think that there are clearly people who have been misled for political reasons over time, political reasons that had to do with the development of various religious denominations, and this notion that of you know, always having someone, some group of people that needs to be the subject of scorn and ridicule. What we believe is that if you look at the Christian tradition and if you look at the teachings of Christ, there's no mention of anti-gay sentiment. In fact, if you look throughout Christ's ministry, what is obvious that you find is him embracing people that otherwise were ostracized even during his the time of his ministry. So the idea that there would be any of God's children that should be left on the outside is one that we believe is really foreign, and that that's the real travesty, and that that's what we have to give voice to those people who are doing that. You know, one of the criticisms of that are hurled at us often is, you know, the National Black Justice Coalition is a secular organization, and it's true, we are, but we have a religious advisory committee that is filled with people who have spent their lifetime studying Scripture, understanding what it means, debating these issues, that are, you know, really a part of our work in bringing and speaking their truth and providing a different perspective on what it means to be open, loving, and affirming.
Well, I certainly am impressed by the list of supporters that you sort of mentioned there. The list of supporters includes everyone from Harvard professors to civil rights leaders to ambassadors. It's very impressive. And I noticed that Coretta Scott King is listed here, and this brings to mind the most recent rhetoric about this has been out of Reverend Ken Hutcherson's mouth, when he gets very adamant that, in fact, the LGBT community never worked with King and was never involved in the civil rights movement. And I'm told that one of King's advisors was a gay man. These are things we don't know about. Could you tell us the true scoop about LGBT involvement back in those days? So many of us do not know.
Well, I think the most significant person that we know for a fact that was involved was Bayard Rustin. Bayard Rustin was an openly gay man who was a very close advisor to Dr. King. In fact, it was Bayard Rustin who introduced the whole concept and notion of nonviolent activism and nonviolent resistance to oppression and discrimination to Dr. King. You know, but if most folks don't know and realize when they look back at the history of the civil rights movement that when Dr. King first became involved, there wasn't a nonviolent movement that was going on at the time. I mean, many people were thinking that the way to respond to the oppression and the violence that was being visited upon the community was in like kind. So there were weapons involved. You know, they hadn't mounted a violent attack, but clearly that was the thinking. It was Van Rustin who had heard about nonviolent resistance, who had studied this, who convinced Dr. King that this was a potential perspective, that had Dr. King pursue that effort. It was Bayard Rustin who was largely the architect of the now historic march on the National Mall. He was a behind-the-scenes player. But because he actually was openly gay, many people in the movement wanted to marginalize him, tried to convince Dr. King to actually expel him from the group. Dr. King was unwilling to do that. But Bayard Rustin's role has been diminished in the history books and in the telling of the story because he was openly gay, but we know that to be a fact. And in fact, Coretta Scott King, before she passed away, talked explicitly about the fact that there were gay and lesbian people that marched along with her, that were part of the movement, and that her support on LGBT issues really came out of that unwillingness to abandon others who were suffering from oppression. So anyone who says that gay and lesbian folks were not a part of the civil rights movement are just misreading history. You know, black gay and lesbian people had to ride at the back of the bus just like every other black person, and were marching and part of the boycotts, were part of the students who sat in at the lunch counters. We have been a part of every movement for social change, and it is only now that we are, you know, stepping forward and saying, you know, there is some unfinished business, and that we are part of that unfinished business of creating a world that's open and that's safe for everybody to be open and honest about who they are.
Well, I love your take on this. I want to ask what you think the reaction will be, or how it will impact. Obama made some very significant, I think fairly strongly worded, comments about LGBT folks when he spoke recently at King's Old Church. It's Ebenezer. I'm sorry, I don't have the full name in front of me. I'm sure you'll know the name. What do you think the reaction will be as a whole, and are you already getting reactions from the evangelical black Christians or black Christians as a whole?
Well, I think it's interesting, and I really applaud Senator Obama for his willingness and his, in some ways, singular capacity to raise these issues in the way he does. I think that because of the excitement and the enthusiasm and the warranted pride that many African Americans feel for what looks like, you know, an individual who looks like he's the first real, really viable man of African descent who could ascend to the position of President of the United States, that he has an opening and an opportunity to educate, and for people to have to hear him and not respond in a way that many others wouldn't. So what we're seeing is that that Ebenezer Baptist Church, as you mentioned, he made the statement about the homophobia and the tendency in the community sometimes to ostracize gay and lesbian individuals in the community. And I think the report said, you know, he received some polite applause, but, you know, there wasn't enthusiasm. But those words have reverberated around the country. And you haven't seen a whole lot of sort of pushback on him as you might have, and as we have with some others. Again, I think it's because he has a position of respect that has people listening, and really, that's what it takes. You know, those of us who are gay and lesbian can speak up on our own behalf, and we need to do more of that. But it also takes those individuals who are our allies, our friends, our supporters, our family members to speak up and say, you know, look, I'm, you know, maybe I believe, this is what I believe. This is what I believe based on my faith. This is what I believe based on my on my understanding of what it means to be free in America. This is what I believe as, you know, as a intelligent, educated person in the community, and that those people who are willing to take the risk of stepping out and speaking in those uncomfortable places. Because, you know, there are many political candidates in life who will come to a, you know, a group of gay people and say a really great thing about their support on the issues. But if you're willing to go into hostile territory, if you will, and call other people on their bigotry, then that really, I think, pushes the issue to another level.
I couldn't agree with you more. That he did that, and I was so grateful that he did that. It certainly needed to be said, and surely he would be the one that could deliver a message like that and have it land with perhaps more credibility than some of the others. We did a story recently about a transsexual, he was a black woman who transitioned into a man, and of course he went through the hormone treatments, and he, you know, all the things happened that he expected. He expected that he would grow a beard. He did. He expected that his voice would get deeper, and it did. He expected that, you know, his relationships would change somewhat with his family and his friends, and he hoped that it would be for the good, and they did change, and it was for the good. But when he moved, I lose the words sometimes, forgive me. When he moved from being a woman to a man, he said something else happened that he did not expect, and that was he had moved from being a black woman to actually being the enemy. Now, what he was referring to is suddenly he was a black man and was subject to all the things like driving while being black. Suddenly he was floored that he was pulled over time after time after time, not driving one bit differently than he ever drove before. You know, seeing women clutching their purses. What would you say to, what are your thoughts about the double prejudices that black male gay folks feel? Or straight transgender?
It's certainly there. And I think that it has some very detrimental impacts. For example, what we're seeing right now is a continued increase in HIV infection among young black gay men, an infection rate that is not matched by young white male counterparts, because the pressures that are felt to keep it secret. As long as you're living a secret life, you can't really talk about what your life is like in a way that is healthy, that allows you to have healthy behaviors, that allow you to develop, you know, as a sexual being in a healthy way. I think that as long as you're oppressed and feel oppressed, you often act out and do things that are self-destructive. I also see it in the impact of it in that, you know, again, people are unwilling to be out and open, and so they can't receive the level of support from their families. You know, it's like people can't love those people that they don't really know, and if you're not really willing to be fully open and honest about who you are, then you miss out on what is central to being healthy, and that is having a very, very healthy and vibrant support system. And you know, I look at it in the workplace as well. There are very well educated African American men who are you would think you know, insecure jobs and the like, but they know that there's still a racial bias in many workplaces, And the notion that they would come out and that they would be open and honest about who they are, they see as just one more barrier, one more thing that they may, in a way in which they would be discriminated against. And I also see it with non-gay, with black men who might be labeled as effeminate, if you will, who are not homosexual at all, but someone might perceive them to be. Another factor, another way of facing discrimination, and sometimes then those men are not even clear why they're being discriminated against. You know, is it someone's perception about their sexual orientation? Is it my race? And then I think the real dual challenge for black gay men, many of whom are out, you know, when an African American child is ridiculed or scorned or marginalized in school because of their race, and they come home to their parents know how to deal with that. They know what kind of support to give them. They know what to say because they've all experienced that. There is a way of handling that. There's a way of addressing whatever institution is engaged in a discrimination. The same is not true often for gay and lesbian folks. If a black gay man experiences that in school, all too often what will happen if it's a violence thing, both the perpetrator and the victim will end up being expelled from school, put into some special remedial program, as they like to do with our young men, and the underlying cause, the homophobia, is never dealt with, and so it does cause multiple problems, and it's why at the National Black Justice Coalition we think it's so important, and we're unique of gay organizations because we see fighting racism and racial bias on par with our work around LGBT and gay issues, because for our constituents, both have to be eliminated in order for us to live healthy, productive lives that are equal and having equal access to the institutions of this country.
Wow. Wondering about the thing that happened with Farrakhan. You know, there was a million more march. Now, I'm not sure if that took place in 07 or 06, frankly, but apparently Farrakhan promised that there would be an openly gay speaker, and then at the last minute he said, no way. And apparently Farrakhan made some sort of remark about down low. Could you tell us what happened there? And apparently yourself and Boykin had to address the media for sensationalize it. Could you give us an overview about that? Many of us don't know.
Well, there were a couple of different things that happened there, and it was very interesting. It was for me, you know, being close up on a story that got lots of media attention, and seeing how some of it was misreported and misunderstood. But we had a series of meetings actually with Minister Farrakhan, and you know, one of the things that most impressed me in one of our early meetings with him was the fact that he said that we were the first openly gay and lesbian folks that had ever sat down and talked to him, that he knew or believed he had been in rooms with and talked to gay people before, but he had never actually sat down with people who said, we are gay, we want to talk to you. And so we did have a conversation with him. And there actually was a speaker earlier, very, very early in the program, who was did not identify as gay, but as the same gender-loving African-American man, but did not have that open message from that we were hoping that would have there. But there were, you know, a lot of issues. We were promised he said that there was going to be a speaker. That was our understanding. But if we got there that day, the day of the march we're speaking of, we were having a pre Millions More Movement rally a few blocks away And then we got the news that, in fact, Keith Boykin, who was the person who we had selected to be the person who would speak, was not going to be allowed on the platform. We were never really given an explicit reason why that happened. And we did have some back and forth. You know, when it comes to talking about issues around HIV and the disproportionate number of African American women who are infected with HIV, you know, men on the so-called down low, in our view, have been scapegoated as, you know, the cause of that. If we look at the data from the way we see it from the Centers for Disease Control and the like, there isn't any real evidence that says that. In fact, what we say is, you know, we need to ask our government, our health department, to answer the question why there is such a high rate of infection among black, among African American women. Because there doesn't seem to be much evidence that black men are any more or less closeted, if you will, more or less on the down low than white men. So why aren't we seeing the parallel thing happening with white women? That there's something more there that's simply not being investigated and so typical of the way things happen. Because it's in African-American communities, people go for the, quite frankly, the easy answer. Let's blame it on a group of people who clearly, there's no doubt there are some men who are not being open about who they are, not being honest with their sexual partners about who they are, about their sexual behavior. But again, there's not much evidence that that's any more pronounced than it is among, you know, heterosexual men or across the races. So, you know, Minister Farrakhan's comments about that and sort of the speculation about those things, we continue to challenge because we think it does two things. One, it scapegoats a group of people who are already, you know, oppressed. But secondly, there's a health challenge. There's a real social challenge that's there, and to presume an answer without actually make an assumption, which is to not really want to know what the facts are, doesn't benefit us in any way if we want to make a change either in those individuals' behavior or the outcomes of their behaviors.
That is so well said, and I had to smile while you were speaking there, talking about the down low. You know, we've got examples of Haggard and who was the wide stance, Larry, and the list goes on and on and on. Talk about the down low, I think.
Right.
Yeah, that's
right.
Priceless.
And they weren't black. So it's like, so why is it that it's, you know, this down low thing is attributed to black men? Again, I think it's, you get a couple of folks who talk about it. You get a New York Times article about it. You get, you know, somebody, you know, you get Oprah to talk about it, and all of a sudden it's an African American male phenomena. When it is a human phenomenon, that in fact many people aren't open and honest about their sexual interactions. And as far as we can tell, that doesn't have anything to do with sexual orientation. That has to do with society's general way or lack of safety around people really being open and honest and talking honestly about sex and sexuality. That's something that all of us would benefit from.
Well said. Very well said. Wondering about your work with people like Service Members Legal Defense Network and Don't Ask, Don't Tell. The reason I bring this up is because I was astounded to read today that black women in same-sex households in the U.S. are far more likely to have served their country in the military than, say, a married or cohabitating women. And the same is true for partnered black men in same-sex households in the U.S. They're far more likely to have served in the armed forces. Is there a disparity in the effects of Don't Ask, Don't Tell on the black community, and also involved in this too? There's apparently a lot of children involved in these relationships. Please tell us about this.
Yeah, there is a disparity, particularly among women, because women who refuse the advances of authorities are often then targeted. So lesbians, labeled as lesbians, targeted, and particularly if they are in relationships, they're there. As you would see, as we see in other subpopulations of the African American community, the military is often seen as a viable option, both for access to education, access to a level of training, advancement that might not otherwise be available to many people in the community. So you do see a large number of our folks, not only in the military but also in government jobs, that despite some of the anti-gay policies, sort of the structure and the notion of the idea that you're rewarded and for your work and your performance is attractive to individuals who feel that they might be discriminated against in other professions or in other areas where, you know, it might be much more personality driven or much more about, you know, who you know and whether or not you go out to dinner with the boss. You know, the military, government jobs, you know, it's about getting the job done, and then so those are favorable environments. It's also true that not only do African-American same-sex couples, are we raising children in larger proportions than our white or Hispanic counterparts, those children are much more likely to be biologically related to us. So in the case of African-American women, they're often their, many of them are their biological children from either a first marriage or a heterosexual relationship. They are our nephews, our nieces, our cousins. We are often, you know, the surrogate, the new parents of last resort. Not having necessarily having children coming out of our own relationship, when there are children coming out of the families who need to be cared for, we are often the ones that care for them. We're much more likely to be caring for our elder, our aging and ill parents as well. Again, we're the ones, we're often the ones, if there's anybody in the family who doesn't have a lot of obligations with children or who has a certain capacity to use their disposable income, we're often the ones who end up in those positions. So we clearly are major contributors to the black community, and we often do that, though, at great sacrifice to ourselves and our own identity, because in order to remain a part of that, we have to obscure sometimes who we are. If you look at the demographics of where black and lesbian folks live and how we move around, we're much more likely to stay at home or close to the neighborhood, much less likely to, like, than our white counterparts who seem to move to to large urban areas away from home. That we're much more likely to be right where the neighborhood is. And what we see across the board, regardless of race, is that people who stay at home are less likely to be out. They're less likely to be open. Their parents are around, their grandparents are around, their aunts or uncles, and it becomes much more challenging to do that. So, you know, that is, again, as we talked about before, an additional burden. But I also think a perspective that's important for African American communities and people to know that, in fact, part of the reason why, if you look at the gay movement, if you will, the people that we see on television, the people who are in some of the marches, the people who are the leadership in the movement, that you often don't see Black gay and lesbian folks, because we're raising children, we're going to the PTA, we're coaching the football league, we're taking care of our elderly parents. You know, we're doing the things that we're required to do to survive and support our community. And so our activism, our ability, our additional resources of time and money to do that is not invested in that way. And it's one of the reasons why I think NBJC, those of us who have are privileged enough to be able to serve the community in this way, is so important, because we understand that there are many that are not in the position to do that right now.
The fact that you're telling me these people have remained in their local area, and by looking at a map I saw today of the general population distribution of Black same-sex couples, many of them appear to be, in fact, a huge number. Look to me by the map as if they're in the rural South. Now, of course, if they're I'm in the rural South, too, by the way. But, of course, if they are in the community they grew up in, they are very likely people who are attending the church and sending their kids to Sunday school and are already well involved in the community in that way. Is that a fair statement?
Yes. Yes, absolutely. Well involved in the community that way. It's suffering from and often living under what I call the original Don't Ask, Don't Tell. That you know, they're part of the community. A lot of people might, you know, in quotes, know how they are or something about their lifestyle or however that's described. But all too often, what we find is that our relationships are not celebrated, and they are not all too often not honored. Which means if there happens to be an unfortunate death of a partner, of a loved one, if there is some dispute over about children and child custody, that in fact our sexual orientation is often used against us, or our partners, our surviving partners, are not recognized, are put out of their home, are marginalized. And so, you know, while we're there and contributing, and that's important and significant and something that we celebrate, our part of our goal is to make it also true that we're doing that in an open way that is also supportive of the individual and supportive of the family that we're creating.
Wow. Alexander, I came across a phrase today in going over materials that I have never heard before. And it's a phrase that I still don't quite understand. In fact, I'll be perfectly honest, I don't understand. And I'm dying for you to tell us what this means. The article is about a Black perspective on same-gender marriage, but the article is called Jumping the Broom, which just fascinates me. What does that mean? And can you give us an overview on that? I'm fascinated by that.
Well, you know, jumping the idea of jumping the broom comes out of an African tradition. That was a part of a marriage ceremony, a part of a commitment ceremony. And, it was something that used often by, in early, African American times, before conversion to sort of Christian traditions, before, African Americans were allowed to even marry in this country. The jumping of the broom, signaling the commitment that this couple had made together, that was a part of the marriage tradition. And so it is still, for many African Americans, something that they integrate into marriage and commitment ceremony. So when we when we were thinking about how to talk about these issues, we wanted to marriage equality for gay and lesbian folks. We wanted to make sure that it, you know, we made it clear and drew in those images of what marriage has meant for people of African descent in this country. You know, we, our families, when we were brought here in slavery, our families were often destroyed and separated. At first, we were not allowed to even marry. Other African-Americans were not allowed to marry other African-Americans. We had to do so in secret. And still, those relationships were not recognized by white society. Then, of course, we had the anti-miscegenation laws, where we couldn't marry a person of another race. Our families, again, our choices about making commitments to others, to the people that we love, were not honored by society. We talk about that and talk about that historic context to say, you know, African Americans should be the last group of people in this country that would deny anyone the right to marry the person to make that they love, to make that commitment, to have the the access to all of the rights, benefits, responsibilities of marriage, because we know how detrimental and damaging breaking people up, trying to deny people the right to build the families that they choose, how damaging that can be to the long-term viability of the community, and that we really need to be about supporting people in building healthy, happy families and marrying the one and making a commitment to the individuals of their choice.
Alexander, that's fascinating. It brings to mind regarding marriage and relationships about, myths, really. I think we can pretty much safely say that amongst the white community, we constantly hear the myth that the reason they're so upset about the LGBT folks coming out of the closet is that we're abducting their children. In fact, Bill O'Reilly did a story not long ago about lesbian gangs kidnapping young schoolgirls. And, you know, it's always a man hiding in the bush or some rigmarole. Is that myth also in the African-American community, or is there another myth that's the favorite scapegoating myth?
Well, you know, it's a scapegoating myth, and it is unfortunately is in the black community, and sometimes it's put out there by people who know better. Now, when we did, we do once a year something we call the Black Church Summit, and it's really an opportunity for us to bring together primarily people who are, you know, with us and supportive and a part of open and affirming congregations to sort of celebrate that and encourage one another. But we decided that it was also an opportunity to have a dialogue with people who disagreed with us, who had a different perspective. And so we invited Bishop Harry Jackson, who is the leader of the High Impact Coalition, which is an African-American coalition, which has their agenda seems to be predominantly one of being an anti-gay group. But we invited him to come in and talk with us. And so he did. And the conversation was going okay. Our group was being respectful of him. And then he started talking about pedophilia and his fear about pedophilia. And, you know, and at that point, it sort of took a turn. I mean, people still weren't rude, but, you know, they clearly thought, well, where is this coming from? After the event, a couple of us approached him and said, well, you know that that's simply... And it had been said sort of in general in the larger audience, but you know that that's not true. He privately acknowledged that if you look at the data, that in fact if you think about pedophilia, that is much more likely to be heterosexual, that most children who are abused, abducted, you know, are done so by a family member, not homosexual family member, by a family member. And so the idea that this is somehow has anything to do with sexual orientation is false. And so it's worse than a myth, because it is often thrown out there as a you know, sort of a stalking horse, if you will, by people who know better. But the one thing, you know, it's one of the places where you can get people really riled up, right? You say, oh, but the children. Oh, we're just worried about the children. The impact it's going to have on the children. Well, you know, the impact, what's important for children is that they are in loving homes where people are taking care of them and that they know and they have a sense of security. And, you know, there are friends of mine who live here in my home state of Maryland, who are raising three wonderful kids who are in foster homes, who their mother was addicted, unable to take care of them. They came to the children came to them with discipline problems, where they were told that one of the boys would never be able to read. They're now all highly functioning kids, well adjusted, doing very well in school because they're in a loving home. And yes, they're being raised by two men, but they know that they're loved and they're cared for. And that's the most important thing that we can do for any child. And that's what we should be focusing on.
Alexander, in the past we've had folks on this show who represent in high schools and also in junior highs and gay-straight alliances. We had, in fact, a student who attends a high school in Denver. She was on with a fellow who represents the organization Gleason, and which they help form these alliances across the country. And she was fascinating. And this whole thing about bullying in school, do you talk to kids that age? Do you hear stories from young black kids and transgendered gay kids about what they go through at the hands of people who bully?
Yes, unfortunately, it's an issue, and unfortunately, it's been a real issue in some of the inner city schools in the D.C. and suburban Maryland areas. I've done work with Clifton, I've done work with Faith Schools, and I admire their work. But I think I alluded to this before. You know, there are a couple of things that are also true about that all too often. That in fact, our kids are bullied, and that some transgender kids, because as we make progress on some of these issues, young people are identifying earlier and earlier, and so the transgender kids find themselves in very difficult and challenging circumstances, gay and lesbian, or even youth who are questioning. They're not sure about their sexual orientation. They're going through that period of life. They feel that they may be gay. You know, they haven't had an experience yet, but that they are often beaten up. The challenge often is that even when we have in place policies that protect these kids, that the violence itself, the bullying, may be dealt with, but it's often unfortunately dealt with, in a relatively legalistic way. So the underlying cause of the bigotry is not always dealt with. That's why the gay-straight alliances, when they are operational, are very important. But what we found is that there are very few of those predominantly African-American schools. They are usually in school districts where the parents that are far less diverse, where the parents themselves have a higher level of education. And so in some of the schools where the bullying and the like is the worst, we don't have sort of that parallel issue around working out the cause of the bigotry along with dealing with any violence or bullying that might happen. So unfortunately, again, you get the young black man who was the bully expelled from school, marginalizing them in their educational experience, turning them into a lifelong adult bully now, who gay bashes on a regular basis instead of really dealing with that prejudice that they may or may not have gotten from the streets in the community that they're growing up in, or the street, or from their home. Unfortunately, in some segments in our community, if there's a pecking order, it's like the notion is, sort of, I may be a black man, and that's not the term that's used, but at least I'm not gay, and that's not the term that's used, but I won't be vulgar here. But there is this notion that you can be, that if, to be black is to almost be on the bottom, except gay people are below that. And so if that's sort of the culture that folks are finding at home, or they're finding right outside their home, they're bringing that into the school, and we don't have any counter to that except to deal with the way that they then act out about it. We're not making as much progress as we can. So, we have been in discussions and have been talking about programs. We don't currently have the youth program, but really looking at ways to bring some of this, these models into, or look at the new models that might work better in some of the schools that are in the inner city that are predominantly African American, where we're dealing with parents who are not as engaged maybe in the process, and that we really have to deal with that root bigotry, homophobia, and quite frankly, the stuff that they might be hearing at church. Let's get real. If the pastor is standing up in the pulpit every Sunday saying it's an abomination, saying how God hates, homosexuality, they're contributing to an environment where, a kid who isn't understanding, doesn't understand the distinction around that, might act out and might believe that they're justified in bullying.
Well, Alexander, I have to tell you, you are just about the most fascinating guest I have talked to in quite a while, and which is not to diminish our other guests. We have wonderful guests here. I have to tell you, too, that I have a bad habit as a host of asking more than one question at the same time. I tend to ramble on, and by the time it's over, I've asked two or three things. And in every case, you have addressed every single thing I've asked without, it's a bad idea to ask more, because, things get lost when you do that. And people like you make me so proud to be part of the LGBT community. I'll have to ask you, in closing, I've fired so many questions at you. Perhaps there are some things that you would just like to say that we haven't touched upon, just to open it up to you.
Well, I just want to say that, two things. First, I want to let people know that we are planning, our major conference that's going to be happening April 24th through 26th, right here in Baltimore. And so if people who are interested, it'll be our Black Church Summit. We're going to have a health and wellness symposia where we're going to talk about not only physical and mental health, but financial literacy, and really think about how we raise the issues of concern to us in this upcoming election year, which we think is so important. So you can visit our website at mdjc.org and check out the conference site there. And then the final thing I would say is a general comment. Our vision at the National Black Justice Coalition and my personal commitment is to creating a world where it's safe for all people to live openly and honestly in every aspect of their lives. And so I challenge anyone, whether you're lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, same gender loving, someone in your family is, or you simply support the rights of all individuals, tell someone, let them know who you are, take a stand. It is so very, very important because it is in our silence, it's in our unwillingness to speak up that hatred and bigotry can thrive. If you shine a light on it, it dies. And so we're all about shining that light and making sure that we create a world that our children can grow up in and fully express who they are in all of its diversity and colors.
Well, that's well said, Alexander. I hope that you will consider both the Head On Radio Network and this show, Strictly Confidential, as an ally. Please feel free to call us and contact us at any time if there are news or updates. I'll be glad to put you on the air right away. And also, too, I feel like with you we've barely scratched the surface. Would you be willing to stop back by maybe for just a little while after the conference to tell us about how that went and some of the new things that are going on?
Oh, absolutely.
That's great news. Again, folks, that's Alex Robinson and Alexander, I'm sorry, and I'm so pleased to have you on the show. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
And good night to you. Folks, that was Alexander Robinson, an amazing man, an amazing interview. The website is nbjcoalition.org. It stands for National Black Justice Coalition. I believe that nbjcoalition.org works, and I think that nbjc.org works. There is also an excellent MySpace page with many videos and a lot of information that it's a great, great page. It's at myspace.com/NBJCDC. You add the DC to it because they're in Washington, D.C., and I'm just so pleased that they joined us this evening. What an amazing guest. Boy, I'm so blessed with the people. Oh, couldn't do it without the chat room and the guests, I got to tell you. So what we'll do at this point in time, we've been running straight now for about an hour and a half. We're going to, well, actually, we've never run straight, but we've been actually proceeding for an hour and a half. We are going to go to the gay bar across the street. Now, the gay bar across the street this evening is not just any gay bar. It is the Trocadero Transfer. And the music that you're going to hear is DJ Jerry Bonham, who is a world-class DJ. And this was done last year. This was recorded in October for the 30th anniversary of the Trocadero. The mirror ball clusters were back up, huge mirror balls, and a bunch of them. They're all lit by arc lights. If you've ever seen an arc light, that's sort of like the search lights they use whenever there's a new building grand opening. You can see the beam way up in the sky. Arc lights, strobe lights, one of the world's most stunning sound systems, and one of the world's most stunning DJs. Also, it was the Pearl anniversary, the 30th anniversary, the Pearl anniversary, so they gave out strings of pearls, and it was legend, absolutely legend. You were really going to love the mixing this evening, and it's, again, DJ Jerry Bonham in San Francisco. Bob, roll it.
That day he walked into my life, he caught me with my guard down. from my heart. You keep breaking.
Yeah.
And there that track closes with Have Mercy. That's Carol Janney, by the way. Wonderful track and wonderful DJ. Wonderful evening at the Trocadero. You really are missing a lot if you don't stop in the chat room. We have a great time there. We were all had a wonderful conversation about a track called Funky Town. We read it last night for one of our moderators, Ms. Sue. And anyway, Bob had a bad experience. When he was a little boy, he was bitten by a copy of Funky Town, and he never quite recovered. So we're trying to figure out all the ways we could possibly sneak Funky Town into the show just because we love Bob. This is the way we show our love on the network. Tomorrow evening, the guest will be Justin Utley, and I'm very much looking forward to hearing from him. He is a musician. He's a singer, songwriter, a musician, and an actor, and he hails from Utah. And he is very much up and coming, and he is out, and he's from Utah. He has quite a story to tell. He is he's not a dance musician as the music we often play. He's an entirely different genre. So if you'd like to find out more about Justin, just stop by strictlyconfidentialradio.com, and you'll find him listed in tomorrow's calendar date, and it will take you to his various sites. I do need to say that there, yes, indeed, will be a horn section this evening, immediately following this program. This program will end at 11, and the horn section will start immediately. It will be myself and Mr. Bob Kincaid and Mr. John Fox from Australia this evening. John Fox will also be doing a live show later this evening at midnight Eastern time. Anyway, God knows where it is in your part of the planet, or even if you're listening in the same day. But John's show will, in fact, be live this evening also. Let's see, what else do I need to tell you? Yes, something I often mention, or forget to mention, rather, during the closing of this show. It's often because I literally run out of the room screaming because I slam up right against the last marker, and I just, bye, see ya, there's Cynthia. But I want to thank the chat moderators who do such a wonderful job of keeping us between the lines in the chat room. They are very helpful. They're posting links. If you participate in the chat, you already know this. If you haven't participated in the chat, you'll find it to be one of the friendliest places on the planet. You will also notice that we have several news ninjas in chat, and we literally could not do the show without our news ninjas. Our news ninjas are constantly on the lookout for articles that would be of interest to our progressive audience. For instance, one of the stories this evening we did was about George Bush's A1 defective gene, which makes him not someone we would like to have in office. I don't have the article in front of me, but the A1 gene apparently makes it very difficult for men to learn from their mistakes. And they constantly screw things up throughout their entire adult lives, much like Mr. Bush has done. And they never seem to learn. They just sort of grin and smile and pretend that they don't have skid marks on their tidy whities. And I assure you, that's the kind of president we have. Highly medicated, beer-sucking, cocaine-sniffing, skid-mark-carrying lout of a man who has run this country so deeply into the ground that, God help us, we may never recover again. And not just this country. 8 years ago, we could have had global warming getting fixed, but that just didn't happen, did it? In fact, the audio I ran of Al Gore last evening, his discussion about gay marriage that he just came out with, we could have had him too. For the last 8 years, we would have had happily married gay folks. We would have had a planet that's not on the point of oblivion. We would have had many things. But no, we got Spawn of Barbara, the white-haired alien woman who apparently squatted and dropped George while she was in a cotton field plowing behind Herbert in a Cadillac, no doubt. Gee, that probably wraps it up. I am so glad to have been with you this evening and to have you here. Stay tuned to the network, and here's Cynthia Manley reminding you, too.
It would turn slowly about and filter the dusk with delicate rainbow colors.
Ask any musician. The best music happens when the sheet music gets put aside and the gang just sits down and jams. Same thing here on The Horn. America's best liberal talk hosts free-forming together for an hour a night. Welcome to The Horn Section. Right here on the Head On Radio Network, America's liberal voice. Now let's crank up the jam. Here's Bob Kincaid.